Hey there, guys. Just a short, not-so-subtle pre-show reminder from your humble host that you're listening to the free first hour of this here THC episode, and we do reserve the second hour of each episode for Plus members, though I don't usually waste your time with ads or plugs. But if you're curious enough to hear more, you can now get a free 7-day trial membership by filling out the short form at the bottom of the page on thehiresidechats.com, so treat yourself. And maybe, fingers crossed, you'll stick around. If it works for Netflix, it should work for me, right? Now let's get this ride moving.
The planet's puppet masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zayas.
Where would we be without THC? We know they're lying to us, just don't know to what degree. Yeah, where would we be without THC? The Higher Side Chat Show, Greg Carwood Company.
All right, Higher Side Chatters, when we examine the small sliver of the human story we call recorded history and squint to make out what little we can past that, it's impossible to deny that cultures on every continent had a serious infatuation with the stars. And despite the many unknowns, the mountain of mythological stories and mysterious structures that are built upon the patterns and movements of little flickering dots of light in the night sky prove just how serious the ancient astrological alignment obsession was to our ancestors. From the Serpent Mountain, Adams County, Ohio, to the Great Giza Plateau, from Chinese mythology to the so-called Holy Bible, there is nearly nothing left that doesn't tie into this persistent preoccupation with the heavens in some way. So I think we can agree it shouldn't be ignored, and we should do all we can to wrap our heads around the reasons for this celestial emphasis in everything. Many of us also recognize that when it comes to empowering ancient stories and esoteric knowledge, there has been a long-standing and well-funded campaign, dare I say conspiracy, to obscure, marginalize, and of course literalize these insightful sagas, to strip them of their internal wisdom and profound truths. Well, ladies and gentlemen, nobody knows the ramifications of this trap better than today's returning guest, David Matheson, because after spending 2 decades as a man of faith, taught by his religious authorities to take the Bible as the isolated and literal truth of the ancient world, he's come to discover the deep star-based symbolism contained within, and the Bible's real place among a plethora of similar ancient stories and symbolic myths that had been hidden from him all those years. So with a vengeance and the fiery passion of a billion suns, David has quickly become one of the most profound proponents of turning back this tide. First, with his weighty tome, The Undying Stars, the truth that unifies the world's ancient wisdom and the conspiracy to keep it from you, which was then followed up by a seriously heavy and thorough 3-volume set called Star Myths of the World and How to Interpret Them, Volume 1 being 500 pages that picks up and compares a great deal of stories from many different pockets of the past, Volume 2 being over 700 pages that tackles the totality of Greek myths and their place in the puzzle, and the recently released Volume 3 that also surpasses 700 pages, focusing on restoring the star myth context to the scriptures of the Bible itself. I've seen phone books that can't match the girth of David's writings, a man on a mission, and I'm happy to have him here. David Matheson, welcome back to the Higher Side.
Hey, thanks, Greg, for that weighty introduction, and thanks to all the listeners. I'm really looking forward to the show today.
Yeah, man. Really happy to be doing it again. Of course, it's been a while since the first show we did. So, you know, maybe to get us started, talk to us about the evolution of your understanding since you put out The Undying Stars a couple of years ago. You've been doing quite a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think we actually, you and I met at the Secret Space Program up in San Mateo in 2014, and serendipitously I was, you know, I had a table right next to yours, and I think that was when The Undying Stars had just come out. So I was on your show in 2014, and we'll get into what I've been doing since then, but I do, you know, with apologies for a quick diversion, I do want to put out a totally unsolicited endorsement of what you're doing and tell everybody out there that I really think everyone should be a Plus subscriber. Greg didn't ask me to say that. He didn't pay me to say that. You know, I really think you're doing a service to the whole world that's listening, you know, that you can listen to public radio and every now and then they'll have a little campaign saying, hey, you know, you should keep us on the air, please donate. And I think the service that you're doing is equally, if not more important. So everyone should sign up to be a Plus member. All right.
Thank you, man. Too kind.
Hey, it's important. Quest for the truth and informing people a lot more than public radio. So anyway, back to what I've been doing. The Undying Stars really laid out. It was the first book that I wrote after, as you note, being someone who took the Bible literally for about 20 years of my adult life, starting when I was a lieutenant in the Army. And I really found a lot of truth and beauty in the Bible and thought that it was supposed to be taken literally. I still believe that it is full of truth and beauty. And actually, I think the good things that you're finding in it have to do with actually the esoteric. Mm-hmm. Nothing is lost by taking it esoterically, except for some of the ways that it's actually inverted and turned on its head. And we can get into that later. So in The Undying Stars, I laid out some of the evidence that the Bible, just like all the other myths of the world, are built on a foundation of celestial metaphor. And I wasn't the first person to make that assertion. That assertion has been made by many people down through the centuries, going all the way back to ancient times. One book that really influenced me on this was Hamlet's Mill. A lot of people have mentioned that. It's been written about, you know, as influential in a lot of people's work. It was published in 1969, and it points to these connections between the myths and celestial cycles and celestial processes like the precession of the equinoxes, but it wasn't really systematic. And so I kind of became obsessed with this as I started to see that it was in the Bible as well. That really threw me for a loop. But once I saw enough examples of it, I couldn't deny it any further. So then I had to really get to the bottom of it. So then I set about to try and understand, okay, if it's not speaking in a literal language, how do I understand the language that it is speaking in? Mm-hmm. And so these three books that you just referenced, this multi-volume series that I'm writing, Star Myths of the World and How to Interpret Them, is an attempt to really systematically try to explain the language and teach this kind of forgotten language to people who are looking for, you know, there are people who are interested in astrotheology, this term that it's kind of a, actually has been around since the 1800s, at least the term astrotheology, but I wanted to really understand it in a thorough, systematic way, and also not just tell people, hey, look at this myth, here's all the astrotheology or here's all the celestial connections in it, but to teach readers how to do that for themselves. And somebody actually wrote to me and said, hey, this is fantastic how you keep laying this one out or that one out, but maybe you could do something to help people learn how to do it by themselves. I thought that was a great suggestion. So Star Myths of the World attempts to do that. And it's almost like learning a language. It starts with the more basic grammar and builds up, and hopefully we become more and more fluent, and then we're able to actually go to the myths for ourselves. Instead of me telling you what I think they mean, you can go talk to them because now you speak their language and you can ask them what they mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, a noble goal worthy of plenty of support as well. And obviously you've been busy with these volumes, and we have kept in touch where we can. And one thing we did have on the docket to discuss before we get too deep into the Star Myths was a message you had sent me after the Joshua Cutchin episode of THC, which was largely about food being involved in strange entity encounters. But we also talked about encounters during sleep or in the middle of the night. And you had mentioned that you went to West Point, and there are accounts that go back decades of a nighttime visitor in one of the specific barracks. And with Halloween right around the corner, I figure you got to tell us a little bit about that.
That's funny. So yes, I did attend West Point as a young 17-year-old. Off I went out of high school.
Look at you.
Yeah, joined the Army at 17. Turned me into a killing machine, right? I don't know if you remember that. That was a
Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, no, it was like a punk song in the 80s, Join the Army. I think it was Sex Pistols or something. Anyway, so I went off to West Point in 1987. And while I was there, I never had any personal paranormal encounters, but there is an older section of post over by the superintendent's quarters, which are known as, formerly known, I think, as Scott Barracks. I was mostly in Bradley Barracks and Pershing Barracks. These are all named after Army generals. And Scott Barracks, they were called the divisions because they were an older style of barracks. And they were numbered, and there was a certain grouping of the divisions that were known as the Lost 50s. And everybody knew because their numbering started at division number 50 and went all the way to the end. That was like the oldest part of the barracks. And everybody knew that the Lost 50s were haunted. And I remember hearing first person accounts of, you know, entities visiting people in the middle of the night, not in a pleasant way. And so I was never actually in those barracks full time, but during the summer one time I was in the barracks, but nothing ever. No, I never had any personal encounters. But, you know, since you asked, I did actually get to go back and teach at West Point and teach in the English department. And we can talk about that when we get into maybe some of the Greek myths. I got an opportunity to teach the Odyssey, which is, you know, fantastic, something mm-hmm. I've loved since I was young. And the head of the English department, actually, he was a colonel, and there's some very large houses not far from the Lost 50s, not far from the old barracks that we're talking about, called Colonel's Row on Washington Road. And I remember going over to his house for an open house, and it was a big three-story building, probably built back in the 1800s. And this is an older colonel who's been at West Point for like 20 years, no-nonsense infantry officer. And as we're getting a tour of his house, it was like kind of a formal open house. And he said, "Oh, and this room up here on the third floor is haunted. You know, when guests come over, they see this apparition by that chest of drawers right there." And his wife said, "Oh, yes, and I've seen her too, the apparition." And I was like, "Okay, I'm not staying here overnight." So he was not joking, and his wife was not joking. They'd lived in this building for a long time. So anyway, back to getting ready for this interview, I went on Facebook to my class and put out a note saying, "Hey, I'm going on this great podcast. And does anyone have any first person accounts?" And I do have a couple to share. I don't want to take up all the time, but you know, what's interesting is a couple of people wrote me back and said, "Hey, you should contact this cadet or this cadet," like three or four female cadets, which when I was there, it was only 1 in 9 cadets or 1 in 10. It was like a 9-to-1 guy to girl ratio. Mm-hmm. So it's actually interesting that apparently female cadets had maybe more paranormal encounters than male cadets did while they were there. I don't know. You know, I don't know what that means. Maybe, you know, women might be more tuned into the spiritual realm than guys are. I don't know why.
Could be.
It's possible. I'm not an expert in, that's not really my expert field, although what we're talking about does touch on the spirit world. We can get into that.
Yeah.
So one person did tell me her story where she was actually not in the Lost 50s, but in a different barracks. And now, you know, 25 years later, she's not, or actually 29 years later, she's not sure if it wasn't, you know, some kind of sleep paralysis or something. And I won't mention her name, but she did say she was actually in room 666 in this barracks.
Wow.
And she said she'd almost fallen asleep and began to hear a multitude of, quote, jabbering voices, and then a pressing sensation, and she couldn't move, a pressing sensation on her chest. And that's actually part of the same pattern in the Lost 50s that people would talk about. In fact, the entity in the Lost 50s was nicknamed the Pusher because he would like hold you down.
Huh.
Anyway, she said she felt like a sensation of a river current moving over and trying to pull her off the bed. And then she heard a strong voice like calling her name and telling her that she'd be taken. And she was really scared that, you know, she was going to die or something. And she started like praying out loud. And then she like felt like the whole current and everything went back into the wall locker of the barracks where it came out of. So she says, looking back, I don't know what it was at the time. She thought it was a creepy paranormal experience, but she's not sure. But another friend of mine contacted me, and he is not a female cadet, but a male cadet, was in the Lost 50s and gave me a first person account. And he said he has no doubts in his mind that it was some kind of a paranormal entity that he saw. And he said, I remember it like it was yesterday. And he was on the fourth floor, second room on the right at the top of the stairs in these narrow old barracks. And his roommate, this was also in our first year while we were still plebes. And this is back before cell phones. I graduated high school in 87. So we used to have to stand outside the payphone booths to call home. So this buddy of mine who told me this story, his roommate got a message from an upperclassman saying, hey, you need to call home right away, a message from his mom. And so he called home, and the emergency was that his high school sweetheart, that he's from, the roommate was from Slidell, Louisiana, and he'd only gone out with one girl his whole life. And his mom and his sister had been out at the movies, and they saw his high school sweetheart with one of his best friends, you know, hanging out at the movies. And so he was like, yeah, he was heartbroken. And so he got back from that was the emergency that his mom had to tell him. Because I guess they were going to get married eventually when he finished West Point, whatever. So he came back to the room, and he was so distraught. He never had taken, you know, a drink or chewing tobacco in his life. And he grabbed my friend's tin of Copenhagen and put like a whole half a can in his mouth.
Oh no.
That was how he like dealt with it. It was kind of like a funny response. I'll get to the actual encounter. So he like got really sick and was woozy and didn't know, you know, he was just like totally distraught over this. You know, he goes off to West Point, and 3 weeks later, his high school sweetheart is going out with his boyfriend. So anyway, that night, the person who's telling me this story, his name's also Dave, said he woke up at 3 a.m., had to go to the bathroom, went to the bathroom, comes back in the room, and he says, I've got the actual quotation. He said, I turn the lights off to go to bed, and as he comes back in the room, his buddy Matt was sleeping, but over the top of him was like this floating guardian angel kind of figure on her knees, kind of praying over him. Huh. That's what he said. He said, I rubbed my eyes. I went back behind. They had in the old barracks, they had these like partition walls, like a little privacy wall. I go back to bed and I look, then I come back around the wall and I look, and it was still there and it was moving. And he said it was floating, it was moving. And then it looked at him and its eyes were like glowing yellow. And he said, I couldn't sleep for like 3 weeks. The quote is, I was scared shitless for 3 weeks. He couldn't sleep. And then there's a account in a West Point magazine from an encounter in the same divisions back in 1973, where there was another figure who it was also plebes again. So this is like first year cadets who are under a lot of trauma and stress. So, you know, that could be a possible explanation. But this, they told this upperclassman, hey, there's a ghost in our room. And we can link up to the actual, you know, first person account. I won't take in too much more time on this. But the upperclassman said, okay, someone's messing with my plebes. Someone's playing pranks on them. So I'll tell one of them, you go sleep in my room and I'll sleep in that bunk, and maybe we'll catch these guys who are playing these pranks on my plebes. So this was back in the late 60s, early 70s. This cadet who was the upperclassman was class of 73. So he graduated in 73, and this probably happened in 72, 71. So he said he was waiting, he fell asleep, and then he woke up. It was freezing cold, and he felt something pushing down on his chest to where he couldn't move. He could see breath coming out of his mouth like on a, you know, freezing cold night. And not only was the hand like pushing him down, but it was inside of his chest. Huh. He could feel this cold hand inside of his chest. But he said he turned over on his side with great difficulty and saw this entity like leaning out of the wall as if it's part of its lower body was still in the wall. And it had these hollow yellow eyes, and it was dressed in kind of like 1800s army uniform. and he said, I waved my hand in front of its face to see if it could see me. And it reacted, it responded to me. And then I, with great effort, kind of hoarsely called over around this same privacy wall and said, "Hey, O'Connor, get over here." And the plebe came around the corner and said, "Yes, sir, that's him." You know, and he said the thing that was most disturbing was it didn't have eyes. It had these hollow, glowing yellow sockets, which is similar to what my friend described, except this was a male figure instead of a female figure. But my buddy also described that it became freezing cold, and that also in that same barracks, you could sometimes not open your door, like something was messing with you. But anyway, so for whatever it's worth, you know, I do think that probably there are points on the planet's surface where maybe there's more activity. I don't know if West Point's one of those places geologically or geographically, or maybe just because of the amount of stress and or kind of energy that's
right
kind of generated at that place. But if there's any place that would have that, I would guess that West Point would be one of them. Actually, when I was at Fort Leavenworth, I was only there for like a 3-week course, but that's one of the oldest. It's in Missouri, actually, I guess your home state, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And some of those really old buildings there, they say, are so haunted that even officers won't stay in them. So what they do is they cycle in, like when they have officers from another country, they put them in those barracks. I don't know why, but whatever.
That's funny, man.
Yeah. So
amazing stories. I'm so glad you had a couple. In that one article that you linked me to in the sidebar, there was also a little blurb about them having a seance at West Point in 1972, where they invited a demonologist to lecture and then attempt to communicate with whatever entities were there. They didn't really say too much about the details of that, but apparently some movers heard a woman whispering in their ear and saw a woman's face in a basement window that a person couldn't really get into that window from that angle. So very weird stuff. And you're right. I mean, who knows? It could be the location. It could be someone who died. But, you know, I do think there's been so many deep state paramilitary experiments dabbling with the occult that I'm inclined to wonder if something wasn't released because of some meddling after hours on base, or because the base was built on an area that was sacred before or something. I don't know. It is strange.
I don't know either, Greg, but that little sidebar you brought up, I mean, that's just another example of why I love THC, is because you do your homework. You know more about this, you know, than most people.
Well, when military people are doing a seance, I've learned that you got to pay attention.
Yep. but I will shut up at this point.
Yes. Anyway, you know, yeah, we got to take it to the stars. But to segue into that, I was curious, you know, in all the work that you have done analyzing so many stories and myths, it's clear that they're connected to celestial patterns. But do you think there is a connection to the spirit world or the entities within it? Do you think that's also central to some of these myths and stories?
Yeah. So actually, that's a huge part of kind of my analysis of what's going on. So as we kind of mentioned, I was taking the Bible literally. I found a lot of truth, beauty, meaning in the scriptures. And I think that, you know, we shouldn't be dismissive of people who are attracted to them, because I do think there's a lot of truth and beauty. But as I realized, and people who have heard me interviewed before probably know that the Samson story was the first real story that I realize this is clearly based on the constellations, and Hamlet's Mill talks about that one. So that was kind of my first, where I started to have some doubts. And then as I saw more and more stories in the Bible that are based clearly on the motions of the stars, then I had to ask, what could be the purpose of this? Is it just some kind of primitive nature worship? That is one explanation that's offered. Is it because people were so overawed by the celestial realm that they decided to kind of worship it? But actually, there's a couple ways that, you know, there's a lot of people who talk about astrotheology, and some of the ways that I think my work is a little bit different, or maybe goes, you know, in a certain direction, is I believe that these celestial actors or celestial metaphors are not simply pointing us to the stars, but they're using the stars as a gigantic training aid or teaching aid or visible representation of the invisible world. Mm-hmm. So we can't see the invisible world, but all the different sacred stories, myths, and scriptures have a worldview that includes not just this material world, but an invisible world, an other world, the realm of the gods, the unseen realm, the seed realm in, you know, the Australian Aboriginal tradition, the translation of what they call it, I believe is called the dream time. It's this realm of spirit, the gods, pure potential. And we can't really see that, but if we want to teach about it, because it's an important part not just of the cosmos that we operate in, this universe that we operate in has a spiritual component, so do we. So we're not just a material entity, we also have a spiritual component. So in order to explain the world that we find ourselves in and explain the situation of who we are, the myths of the world use the heavenly realms as kind of a proxy or as a way of understanding the invisible world. That is really basic to kind of my understanding of what's going on.
Right on. And I also checked out a recent video that you had put out that you sent me, where you talk about theories of guys like Graham Hancock about a unified source of ancient knowledge, a lost civilization, or, you know, like a cedar culture. And you say that you see this very clearly in the work that you've been doing. Can you talk to us about the best evidence of that, that you're finding in your wheelhouse of looking at star myths and mythology?
Yeah, sure. So just to kind of lay out in a couple sentences what my central hypothesis is and what I'm arguing is that all the world's myths, scriptures, and sacred stories, ancient scriptures, ancient myths, and, you know, traditions that have been handed down are built on a system of celestial metaphor where it's a very specific system. Like the same patterns will emerge over and over to where it's quite clear to me, I'm convinced it's the same system around the world. In other words, the myths of ancient Greece are built on the exact same system that the stories in the Bible are built on. The same constellation, for instance, the Northern Crown is this beautiful little constellation that you can see. It's pretty far north in the sky. It's a beautiful little arc of stars, and it appears in different myths, sometimes as a necklace, like the necklace of Freya that gets stolen by Loki in the Norse myths. It also appears as a necklace in the ancient Mesopotamian mythologies of Sumer and Babylon. It also appears as a necklace in the stories of ancient Japan. Okay, but we could look at that little arc of stars and say, you know, that does look like a necklace. It's really not that surprising that somebody in Japan, somebody in modern day Scandinavia or Northern Europe, and somebody in Mesopotamia might see that as a necklace. But that same little arc of stars appears as an infant in a lot of myths. And if you've ever had a baby and, you know, been in the business of changing diapers and trying to put a baby to bed, when an infant gets really agitated, sometimes it'll arch vigorously, like really, really arch and scream and just pitch a fit. I don't know why, but the ancient myths analogize that little arch or analogize that arc as an arching baby in a lot of myths. In the Maui myths, a baby that's either held up, like grabbed out of the fire by his grandfather, Maui is hung up in the rafters to dry. Well, his grandfather is the constellation Hercules that's right next to this arch of stars. He hangs a baby up in the rafters to dry. Well, that pattern is found in other myths around the world. And like we know Achilles, remember he was dipped in either the river Styx or in some magical fire in order to become invulnerable. Mm-hmm. It's the same when he was a baby, it's the same constellation that's at the root of that story. Even in the myth or the story of Solomon in the Old Testament, there's this Judgment of Solomon, where these two women, actually they're described as two prostitutes, have had children, and one of them has died and one of them is alive, and one of the women switches the babies, or the other woman claims, hey, she switched my baby on me, and they both go to King Solomon, and he's supposed to figure out which baby belongs to which mother, this famous Judgment of Solomon. It's a really important story, but it's not a literal story. It's got all kinds of deep messages for us we could talk about. But anyway, in that story, Solomon says to a swordsman, hey, I know, we'll just divide the baby up. The living baby, we'll give one half to one mom and one half to the other mom, solve the problem. Swordsman, grab the baby. So the swordsman grabs the baby. And if you look at paintings down through the centuries, the baby is always arching vigorously as it's being held by the heel by this swordsman who's about to cut it in half. That's because the constellation Hercules has this huge sword. He's this kind of giant menacing figure right next to the crown. Well, somehow all these cultures around the world are using as a metaphor this arc of stars as a baby. And when we look at some of these constellations, we do not naturally say, ah, that looks like a baby, or ah, that looks like a beautiful woman. But around the world, it shows up in the myth as a baby in almost the exact same pattern, always getting hung up in the rafters or hanging over the fire. So what I'm saying is this kind of example, and I could cite lots and lots of examples. That's just one that's a very common pattern around the world that is not really something you would expect people to just kind of hit on independently. So what I'm arguing, I said I was going to give you a brief a brief explanation, but I started going down some stories. What I'm arguing is that all the stories around the world are using this same ancient system. It's a very amazing system. It's a very profound and beautiful system, but it's worldwide. You can find it in Australia. You can find it in Africa. You can find it in Scandinavia, Norway. You can find it in the Americas, in the Maya, across all every inhabited continent on our planet, and across all the islands of the Pacific, and you know, all these different cultures. So the question is, where did it come from? And I believe that this, it's evidence that there's some, it's probably evidence for some common, very ancient source, a source that's so ancient that it predates ancient Egypt, because they're using the same system that can be shown, and I could talk about that. It predates the Gilgamesh epic, which is also one of the first things that we have written down on these clay tablets, going back to at least 2000 to even earlier BC. So it predates the earliest civilizations that conventional history knows about. And now that we've found Göbekli Tepe, in addition to all the other evidence that people like Graham Hancock or Robert Schock or John Anthony West were talking about even before they found Göbekli Tepe, you had all these people arguing even before Göbekli Tepe, hey, it looks like there's something far more ancient than ancient Egypt. Look at the Sphinx, look at this weathering, et cetera, et cetera. And they were completely dismissed by the historians and conventional archaeologists said, no, that's ridiculous. Show me some pottery from, you know, from this supposed civilization that you're always talking about. Well, then Göbekli Tepe gets unearthed, and it's been found to be at least 10,000 BC, not 10,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, 10,000 BC, and completely covered in dirt no later than 8,000 BC, deliberately, probably because of some sort of cataclysm, or the people were trying to protect it or preserve it. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know for sure why, but it's clear evidence for an extremely ancient civilization. Well, that's one good explanation. There are other possible explanations, but that's one good explanation for why we find around the world this common system everywhere.
Right.
Another explanation could be, oh, well, maybe the Egyptians sailed around and told everybody about it. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that explanation is, like, the Maori of New Zealand or the myths of Hawaii were not really from a culture that was at the same time as ancient Egypt. So right. it's more probable to me that they all came from some original ancient source. And then the people from maybe this, you know, that survived this ancient cataclysm spread out around the world over the different millennia, and the myth started to take on kind of different cultural aspects, and the gods and goddesses and heroes and characters started wearing different clothes or having different names, but it's all the same ancient system. Long answer to a good question.
No worries. I mean, you're right. The idea of a cedar culture, lost civilization, we do see these things all over the world. And another thing I want to ask you about is the East, because, you know, you've looked at cultures all over. We talked about Greece, we talked about the Bible, but when you bring in China and Japan and other areas of the East, we see similarities in their myths too, right? I mean, there's definitely a connection even between what we consider to be kind of separate worldviews. There's a connection between the myths that kind of crosses that barrier, right?
Yes, they're absolutely. That's demonstrable. And it's not, you know, an area that I've taught on at the college level, like with the Greek myths. But first of all, Hamlet's Mill details some. But for volume one, I outline some myths from China, including the myths surrounding how we got the Tao Te Ching, right? The Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu or Lao Tzu, depends on which, you know, version of Chinese you're speaking, whether it's Cantonese or Mandarin or Putonghua or Guangdonghua, supposedly disappeared off through a gate on the back of a water buffalo. Well, but he handed off this scroll as he, you know, or the gate guard said, "Hey, can you give me your knowledge before you disappear off forever?" And he said, "Okay, well, I'll write this down." He wrote down the Tao Te Ching. Well, disappearing on a water buffalo, you know, we haven't talked too much about the precession of the equinoxes, but, you know, the age of Taurus is followed by the age of Aries and then the age of Pisces. There's actually more to that story that does involve a ram later on, like not Lao Tzu, but his follower had to go find this black ram in the marketplace. So there's even connections to the Tao Te Ching, which doesn't use a lot of mythological. It teaches, I believe, the same truths, but it does so in a more mystical fashion that doesn't use a whole lot of gods and goddesses running around having battles. Mm-hmm. But it is definitely in ancient India. And there are other stories in ancient China that can be shown to be based on celestial motions. They have someone who's known as Huang Di, the Yellow Emperor, is related to, you know, the age of Saturn is this golden age, Saturn, Kronos. He's also connected to Osiris, this lost king. And I could explain the celestial, running low on time, but I could explain why I believe the myths talk about Saturn as the king of this world, because yes. Saturn is the king of the underworld. Osiris is the king of the underworld. And it has to do with the precession of the equinoxes. Osiris is definitely pretty widely acknowledged to be connected to the constellation Orion. And Orion, as precession, take a little bit of time to explain it, so I won't explain the details. You can go on my website or go to other people who have explained it. But precession causes the background of stars to be delayed, so they don't rise at their appointed time. They're delayed, but it's not on a night-to-night basis. It's on the appointed day from one year to the next, and it only happens over 72 years, they'll be delayed by only 1 degree. So it takes thousands of years to move from the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius.
Right, 26,000, right?
2,160 if you use 1 degree for 72 years, which is actually, it appears to be right now, 1 degree every 71.6 years. We don't know if that's been constant. It may have, the speed of precession may be slowing down or speeding up, okay? But 2,160 years would be one age, because a zodiac sign, if there's 12 of them, is 30 degrees, because 12 times 30 is 360, the full zodiac. So what happens is the constellation gets delayed so that on a specific day, let's say the spring equinox, because that's a very important specific day, the constellation that's supposed to be there right before the sun rises will be delayed over time, and thousands of years later, it'll still be down below the surface. And you'll say, "Hey, wait, where's Orion?" Orion's actually not a zodiac constellation, but he's underneath Taurus. He's next to Taurus. He's actually closer to Gemini. So during the age of Gemini, Orion would be coming up over the horizon, and that's before the age of Taurus, so really far back. So he was the king of the golden age, but as precession delays him, delays Gemini as well, then Taurus takes over. And on the special day, the spring equinox, you look and go, wait a minute, Taurus is there. What happened to Gemini and Orion? Except this happens over thousands of years. So even in one lifetime, it's not enough to see it. So somebody had to keep really good records. But anyway, that means Osiris or Orion has been held down below in the underworld, right? He's been drowned. He's been held beneath the surface of the earth. So he becomes the god of the underworld. So as, like I said, the sun sails through the sky. That's Horus up there, the falcon mm-hmm. god. That's Horus is a sun god. Osiris is also a sun god, but Osiris is the sun after he sets. And then he has to plow through the underworld to get back to the eastern horizon. And then, boop, he pops back up. And now he's a heavenly Horus again. So it's just like the higher self and the lower self, except now we're talking about the sun. Okay, so that's why I believe that the Osiris figures are the gods of the underworld, where there's one in ancient China who's the yellow emperor. He ruled over a golden era. Cronus or Saturn is the king of the underworld. Well, that's this life. So when people say, oh, Saturn myth, Saturn is, I mean, there's lots and lots that's been written about that.
Well, there's researchers that I've interviewed that talk about the Brotherhood of Saturn or the Saturn death cult and some of the symbolism of Saturn that we see in the companies that the elite run. So there's a lot of speculation about like secret Saturn worship, like a dark sun worship. And yeah, that's why I think Saturn is interesting. But yeah, sorry.
I think those people are definitely either knowledge about this or very interested in this. This is historically provable that certain societies are extremely steeped in this stuff. And actually the word elite comes from the name of the god El or Ellus, which is another name for Cronus or Saturn. El, or at least some people have alleged this. El, like, right? El Elohim. People whose names are Elijah or Elizabeth, right? They have that god's name in their name. So elite is related to that, and it is related to this system that we're talking about, I believe. So anyway, that is actually, I think, a tangent to another point that we were making, but I forgot what it was a tangent to. But the holding down of Orion, it's all these myths come from the cycles, but I don't believe that it's just like kung fu or karate can be used. You can have a evil kung fu guy or gal. You can have a good kung fu. One can use it to protect the people and one can use it to oppress the people.
That's true.
So I believe that procession is not actually an evil thing. And I don't think that Osiris is an evil thing. I think it has to do with telling us about, hey, this is your lower condition and you're supposed to. Procession is a way of, at least on one level, depicting our disconnection from the spiritual world, mm-hmm. something that needs to get corrected. In the Odyssey, he has to get back home to his wife. His wife is being pursued by these boorish suitors who are violent and want to kill Odysseus's son, steal his wife, take all his lands. And actually, the number of the suitors is 108. If you add them up, you know, the Odyssey says, well, 20 came from this part of Greece and 20, they add up to 108. That's a processional number. So
that's a lot of suitors.
Yeah. Well, so that's why he couldn't just waltz in and say, hi, I'm Odysseus and I'm here to fight you all. He had to do it in a smart way. And he had to get Athena, the goddess, had to help him to figure out a plan. But the point is, it's a processional number. Procession has to do with our separation, a situation that, you know, we're down here in this world. We're supposed to connect up with the spirit world. We're supposed to not just ignore it. We're supposed to be integrated with it, not at odds with it. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
No, I love that. And I do have a couple other questions left on the roster for you, if you got a little bit of time.
Oh, yeah. I got all the time that you want to ask questions. I don't want to wear out your microphone, but I don't want to feel also like you're just on the verge of getting to something that you wanted to ask.
Well, I was curious because you also have talked to me about the importance of Robert Taylor and the Devil's Pulpit. Both Crow and Santos Bonacci brought up the Devil's Pulpit in previous shows. But I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on it, or if you could expand on it a little more, because it seems to be something that a lot of high thinkers find to be very valuable.
Yeah. So Robert Taylor, just so everyone knows, I believe he lived from 1784 to 1844. I'm just quoting off of memory, so that might not be exactly right, but he lived in England and he was a minister, but he apparently had a conversation. He actually attributes his kind of conversion to seeing that the Bible was based entirely on the constellations to a conversation he had with a certain miller, you know, a person who grinds up, you know, back in those days, they would grind wheat with a millstone that was powered by water, basically, you know, to make flour. If you want to make bread or tortillas or anything, you better have flour. So this miller, I think he attributes it to a conversation he had to a miller who said, a certain free thinking miller who pointed him in this direction, and the rest is history. So I wonder how many ministers do suspect this. Well, Robert Taylor kind of had the courage of, once he decided, he didn't like pretend like he still believed it was literal. He went fully, hey, I can't keep this a secret. I got to explain. The people who are calling me a heretic are the ones who aren't reading it the right way. I've got to tell you, this is the way it works. And I think he's probably the clearest and most systematic explanation of the Bible texts matching up with the constellations of any that I've seen. There's been a lot of people through history. There's a French author not too far before him, Charles François Dupuy, who lived in the 1790s, so pretty much contemporary. But Robert Taylor is very instrumental. Once I started seeing from Hamlet's Mill, okay, this is based on the stars. Okay, that's based on the stars. Now I can't stop seeing it because I already knew the stars pretty well, and I knew the Bible pretty well because I've been studying it very seriously from a literal perspective. Then reading Robert Taylor, who I heard about through Santos Bonacci, whom you just mentioned, and I've put links on my website. If you go to starmythworld.com, at the bottom, if you scroll to the bottom of any of those long pages, you'll see a link that says resources, where I link up to places where you can read online the books by Robert Taylor. Are, you know, they're so old that they're online, public domain. He wrote The Devil's Pulpit and another one called Astronomico-Theological Lectures, which is very similar to the word astrotheology. He actually uses the word astrotheology a couple of times in his lectures. So these were published actually a few years after his death. So he didn't necessarily write them. He was preaching and people came to listen to him. And I think he became more and more popular and with certain people, unpopular with other people. And he was actually, you know, defrocked, kicked out of his ministry, probably some economic ramifications to losing his job. And he was also thrown in jail a few different times for spent a total of at least, I believe, about 3 years in jail for teaching these interpretations of the Bible. So he's very systematic. I don't agree with every single interpretation that he makes. And the excuse that I would give is he didn't have H.A. Rey's system. So he's incredibly insightful. If only he could have seen the outlines that H.A. Rey started publishing in the 1950s, what a great tool that would have been for Robert Taylor. But Robert Taylor's analysis of these myths is excellent. And I cite him a lot when I'm talking about star myths of the Bible. But there's some that, you know, some stuff he doesn't talk about, or some places where I may have some slight disagreements. So I talk about some parts of the Bible that maybe he doesn't cover. But you can read both those books online on the web, or you can also buy them, which, you know, I have physical copies of some of these things as well, just because I like to have them.
Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating, man. I'm glad you brought a lot of that to light. That's a great explanation.
Oh, before we leave Robert Taylor, I do want to say, so one big difference between him and me is he does say, hey, these are beautiful, these are spiritual, but actually he's like really cutting sarcasm. And I think he kind of says they're beautiful and spiritual, but they're kind of like, you know, primitive man's gropings after the stars. At one point he says, you know, this is like wild, you know, our wild primitive ancestors who were practically orangutans, you know, I think he says. And actually, I think he may have influenced Charles Darwin. Some people have said Darwin actually got the idea from Robert Taylor. I don't know if that's true or not, but I don't think that I think they came from an advanced an extremely advanced, spiritually advanced civilization. Just, you know, the Native American spirituality is extremely advanced, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying, oh, this came from a civilization that was flying around in, you know, silver suits in gleaming gigantic cities. I'm saying this came from spiritually incredibly advanced people or plants,
right?
You know, or whatever.
Well, just look at the megalithic structures and their alignments. I mean, there's obviously some intelligence in our ancient ancestors' brains that, you know, modern history and anthropology doesn't want to touch.
Right. So I'm saying it's incredibly spiritually advanced. Whether that meant they had, you know, dishwashers, I have no idea.
Right. Exactly.
And Robert Taylor, I think, would disagree or seem to disagree on that score. So his interpretation of what they might mean might be a little different, but he was incredibly insightful and valuable to read.
Right on. And I also just thought I would ask you, I mean, you've looked at dozens and dozens and hundreds of myths and stories from around the world, a wealth of knowledge, and a lot of people don't have that kind of experience in studying these things. I thought maybe you could just give us a personal favorite, maybe a more obscure myth that contains a message that resonates with you that the audience might appreciate, that's kind of easy to see the symbolism in.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, I like trying to pick your favorite. Right? yeah, so they are they're so fantastic. And I did kind of envision, oh yeah, we're going to do 8 or 9 different myths during this, you know, because Greg has this great long form show. And then here we are at the end of our time.
We ate it up.
Yeah, we ate it up. But we talked about some great stuff. So, you know, I know I've talked about it before, but I do think this ties on some other shows, and we can get even more obscure than this one if you want. But, you know, I've heard you talk about Mahabharata, this great battle. It's spelled Mahabharata, but, you know, people who speak Hindi have told me, hey, you're pronouncing that wrong. It's Mahabharata. A lot of the A sounds are dropped off at the end. Maybe back in ancient Sanskrit, they weren't dropped off. But in any event, in that story, Arjun, whose name is Arjuna, he's like one of the greatest warriors. And he's going into this great battle of Kurukshetra, this huge battlefield. It's like this almost Armageddon scene. Okay, it's a lot actually like the Trojan War also, where we have kind of one side, I believe, represents the lower half of the year. One side represents the upper half of the cycle. So I think all these battles are celestial. They have all kinds of celestial clues and characteristics of the characters. Like one character carries a gigantic mace, a huge mace. That's like, and he's basically a Hercules type character, Arjun's brother, Bhim.
Mm-hmm.
Carries this huge mace. His name is spelled Bhima, but he carries this huge mace, just like Hercules carries a huge club, because they're both related to the constellation Hercules, which is often the most powerful figure in any mythology will be related to that constellation, right? In the Norse myths, what figure do you think might be related to the constellation Hercules? Who has the most powerful weapon?
Thor?
Exactly. So He's a Hercules figure. He's different than Odin. Is a very different kind of a character. Odin isn't the most strong, but he's a different constellation actually. So Thor has his hammer. I believe Zeus is also associated with the same constellation, and he has the thunderbolt. So anyway, in this battle of Kurukshetra in the Mahabharata, and I would say everyone who's listening, if you haven't, you know, people in India actually, they have all kinds of movie versions of Mahabharata. You can go on YouTube and watch them with subtitles. They even have animated versions, so you can do it that way. You can read the whole version online. It's like massive, in a translation from the 1800s, the Ganguly translation is online. You can find it just by searching for Mahabharata. But there's also a great version. It's a little bit abridged by someone named Krishna Dharma. I believe he's a monk. He's from England, so he's, you know, a Western individual who has been given, you know, sometimes when you become a monk in certain traditions, you get a new name. So his name is Krishna Dharma, fantastic version of Mahabharata. But anyway, Krishna, the god, helps Arjun. And in this battle, Krishna is the charioteer for Arjun. And so Krishna says, I won't be a combatant, but I will guide your chariot. And I will steer your chariot around. And Arjun is this great bow. He's a great bowman. He has these powerful weapons. He actually goes up to the heavens and gets these celestial weapons, which I believe has to do with the spirit world. But I believe he's also probably an Orion figure because of the bow. There's actually an episode in Mahabharata, just a real quick tangent, where he does this feat with the bow in order to win the most beautiful woman in the world. This is a feature of many, many myths. In fact, in the Odyssey, when Odysseus comes back, in order to win his own wife back, he has to do a feat with a bow. No one else can string the bow, let alone perform this amazing feat of archery. So anyway, Arjun is this archer, but Krishna is the charioteer. And before the battle of Kurukshetra, both sides are arranged on the battlefield, and Arjun suddenly starts having all these doubts, because on the other side are a lot of his uncles and teachers, his own martial arts instructor from when he was young, who taught him how to use all the weapons, kind of this grandfather figure, this you know, like kung fu revered figure. And he's like, I don't want to go into battle against them. I can't kill my own revered relatives. And he says, Krishna, just take me out to the middle of the battlefield. I think I'll just sit down here until someone kills me, because I can't lift my hand up in this battle. And Krishna says, hey, Arjun, let me explain to you. You have to go into this battle. It's your duty. Okay. And then he gives him this great series of examples. And that long discourse from Krishna actually is the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita that, you know, many people have heard of is this revered discourse from Krishna. It's actually part of the Mahabharata, where Krishna is telling Arjun, listen, you have to do what's right and don't worry about the outcome. That's the main message from Krishna, is don't be attached to the outcome, whether it's an outcome that's bad for you or good for you. Your job here is just to do what's right, and you have to descend into this battlefield. And I believe it's a metaphor for descending into this world. It's like, why would we want to descend into this material world? We're here in the spirit world. And Krishna says, hey, you have to, for certain reasons. And one of the things you're supposed to learn is to do what's right. And we get lots of chances to not do what's right. And we excuse and we say to ourselves, I don't want to do what's right because those bad guys might not like it and they might kill me, you know, if I start talking about this or whatever. You're not supposed to be attached to the outcome. Also not for your own gain. You're not supposed to do what's right because, if I do what's right, I'll get lots of money. Mm-hmm. Krishna says, no, that's getting attached to the outcome. So that's the message that Krishna keeps saying to him over and over. But one of the neat things is that Krishna is like the higher self. He's like the divine self. In other ancient Indian scriptures, this metaphor of the chariot, the horses of the chariot are like our passions and our senses, and even actually the reins are like our mind. And some of these kind of yogic texts say, hey, you have to get control of your mind. Mm-hmm. And sometimes your mind will run away with you. Mm-hmm. And so I think this picture of Arjun in the chariot, getting ready to go into this battlefield of this life, but having Krishna, the divine charioteer, actually controlling the horses, is a picture. They're trying to say, hey, let me explain to you what it means to have like your senses and your mind and all your emotions, all those great, powerful lust and appetites that you have. Those things are all great. And they're powerful horses, but you can't let them run you off the cliff. So what you want to have is let them power you through, you know, the battlefield. You want to have strong horses, but don't try and grab the reins yourself. Let Krishna hold on to the reins. So this picture of Arjun and Krishna in the chariot with the horses, like if you're trying to meditate, it's like trying to let your mind, is it going to be running around like this helpful? This is a great example that someone gave. It's kind of like Michael Scott in The Office. You know, Michael Scott. He's like, oh, I'm the office manager. I got to do something. We have this problem and I'm going to come up with this creative solution. And his solution is always like horrendous, you know. Yeah. It like totally backfires. It's totally awful.
He needs to get in tune with his higher self.
Well, he's like our lower self, mm-hmm. our mind. He's like our mind. Our mind wants to help. It says, oh, you got this problem? Hey, why don't we do this? It's like, okay, it's not like your mind is trying to be an idiot. It's trying to actually help out, but you got to like get your higher self in touch with, that's higher side chats, right? You got to like, you got to get in touch with your higher self to like say to the mind, okay, thanks very much. Now you keep chattering over there while Krishna's in control here. It's a great picture of your mind's never going to be not doubting, not having problems. And so Krishna, Arjun is doubting. He doesn't want to go into the battlefield. He says, this is going to turn out bad. I don't want to do it. I just sit down here and do nothing. He's experiencing this moment of doubt, this tremendous moment of doubt. And this is embodied in the myths over and over. In fact, if you're familiar with the Bible, you might be saying, what doubting? What does that remind me of? Oh, doubting Thomas, right? Doubting Thomas. Jesus has come back, the risen Christ, and all the disciples have seen him, except Thomas happens to be somewhere else. And so they all say, hey, we saw the Christ is risen. And Thomas says, I didn't see it. I don't believe it. I won't believe it unless I actually touch his hands. And then there's this encounter. And Christ doesn't say to Thomas, oh, Thomas, you're terrible. You have these doubts. Don't have doubts. He does say stop doubting and believe. But he doesn't ever say that we shouldn't have doubts. Thomas is like our lower mind. Okay, the doubts, they're actually there for a purpose. We're supposed to have, like if I leave the house and I left the stove on, it's probably good if I start doubting halfway down the road. Did I turn the stove off? I better check. That might be a good form of doubt. So you're never supposed to get rid of Arjun. You're never supposed to get rid of Thomas. Christ doesn't say, oh, Thomas, you doubted, so get out of here. You're not my disciple. He says, believe. And then Thomas says to Christ, my Lord and my God. In other words, you could take it literally. Oh, this is about trusting in. But I think it's actually a picture of you're supposed to be just like Arjun in the chariot, letting Krishna hold the reins. That's his job. You have to get in touch with your higher self. There's a role for your higher self. There's a role for your lower self. It's just like Daniel-san when he comes to Mr. Miyagi and he's like, Mr. Miyagi, I don't believe you're trying to teach me karate or anything. And Mr. Miyagi just like shows him, boom, you do know karate. He doesn't say, oh, Daniel-san, you miserable doubting person. He just shows him, just like Christ just shows Thomas, just like Krishna. Boom. That's what you're supposed to, that's the picture of kind of what we're supposed to be becoming integrated with our higher self. Yeah. And there's many myths where it's a female character too, or a female higher self. I just happen to pick that one. It's a really powerful picture to me. I think it's a great illustration.
Right. What a positive and enlightening choice. I, you know, my cynical mind would have chose something like Sisyphus rolling the rock up a hill over and over again. Because when I look at the Rothschild Rockefeller reality and the never ending consumer cycle, that's what I think of.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, they contain those profound truths. So to put a fine point on all these things we've talked about, do you think we'll ever get back to widespread adoption of this proper context, or have these mythologies and divine truths been so distorted and so marginalized that the mainstream will probably never get it back again, or maybe not even care again?
Wow. Well, I do acknowledge that what I'm writing is probably not something that everybody is just rushing off to the store to say, oh, I need to get that. There's some people that are like, I'm just not interested in that. But there's some people who are really hungry for this. Like, obviously, I was like really, once I started to see it, I couldn't not continue to want to understand it.
Yeah.
And I believe it's extremely powerful. And I mentioned a couple of times, I think that actually the attraction of these ancient scriptures, texts, and sacred stories is actually very powerful to all people. And I think they are actually very beautiful. And that's why there are so many people who actually take them literally. They're looking for something that these texts and stories do actually have the ability to give you. Even if you're getting them through these different filters, or maybe, you know, you're listening to them translated to you by someone who doesn't actually speak the language that they're speaking, but maybe still some lights of beautiful stuff shines through. The problem is literalism tends to invert some of the message. So I believe this message is, hey, if everyone has a higher self, if there's a spirit world that's always present, if everyone has a divine spark, then that means that every single person you meet, you're not supposed to look at them just by their outer form. Maybe they're an outer form where you go, oh, that person, oh, I just don't like them. They're a slob or whatever. Well, they don't just reduce them to their outer form. Every single person is a spiritual being that has a higher self and a divine spark. So the point is, if that's the message of the myths, how does it get inverted into, well, some people, the Bible says some slavery is okay because some people have to be slaves. That is a total inversion of a story, like the story of Noah and his three sons. I've written about it in a few blog posts. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Its literal interpretation has been misused down through the centuries to say, oh, people who are descended from Ham were cursed because in that story, Ham doesn't do what's right and the other two brothers do. So Ham got the curse of Noah, and therefore the Hamitic races have to be, cursed. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a total misreading. It's a literalizing inversion of what I believe the text is actually talking about. What does Shem and Ham do? Their father Noah actually plants the first vineyard, gets drunk, gets passed out drunk, falls asleep, and apparently uncovers his nakedness, or they come across him and he's drunk, passed out naked on the floor or in the dirt. Ham points out his nakedness, and two of the brothers walk backwards with a sheet to cover his nakedness because it's their father. And they're like, here's the point. Everybody, if you drink enough wine, we're all physical beings. You drink enough whiskey, you're going to pass out. It's a physical phenomenon. We all have this physically weak body. We're in a body of weakness. So we can laugh at that and try and bring everyone down to the physical level. We can put them down and call them names based on their material condition, right? If you think of almost every curse word, it has to do with trying to like call someone a body part or call someone a bodily function or something physical. It's bringing them down to the most physical level. And that's what Ham was basically doing in that story. And the other two said, wait a minute, even though he's in this bad physical condition, this weakness, he's exposed his weakness, but that could be any of us if we drink too much. Let's honor the fact that he's also got a divine spark. He is our father. Let's revere him. Let's walk backwards with a sheet. That can all be shown to be constellations. So the sheet is the great square of Pisces that you can see overhead right now if you go out at night in the northern hemisphere. But if it's all constellations, then that means it's not about three literal sons of a literal guy named Noah, because it's all constellations. And Ham is actually the goat Capricorn. It becomes a scapegoat. So it's not any people who are descended from the constellation Capricorn, but that's the way it's been applied. So that's an inversion, because the story's about honor the divine spark. Don't put people down to the physical level. And how's the story been interpreted? Some people are descended from Ham. We can tell by their physical lineage, so they can be put down. So the story's been totally turned on its head.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? It's like the story's about don't reduce people to physicality. And the interpretation that's been given, if you literalize it, it can easily been and has been interpreted as, oh, some people are descended from Shem. Some are descended from Japheth. And they get to rule over the people descended from Ham. What? That's a physicalizing. So I think it's a super important message of all the myths, is that it's supposed to bless and uplift to the spiritual, try and bring that out in others and in ourselves, rather than try and, oh, let's just put everyone down into the physical layer. But how do you get someone down into the physical layer? Well, you start hitting them enough in the nose, and pretty soon that's all they can think of is their physical layer. Like, you can get someone to just operate on the physical level if you just start putting them in fear or in physical pain.
Right.
Right. So
economic stress.
Yeah.
Simulated, but also very powerful.
Or real. Yeah. Economic stress is real. I can't feed my family. It's the end of the month and I'm out of money. I guess I better hit up the credit card to buy some beans.
And you want me to look at the stars?
Right. So, So your question was, will we ever get back to this
widespread adoption?
I believe that people are really actually yearning for the true message of these stories. And you can find it in any of them, Mahabharat, Odyssey, Iliad, the Gnostic texts about Sophia. All these treasures that were given to us actually have, I think, what people are hungering for. And so I do believe that the good parts is probably what people are going to church for in the first place. It's like that's, if it's speaking to their lives, you know, unless they're psychopathic and want to put other people down, which I don't believe describes the majority of people who are searching for these things. I think the good aspects that they're looking for are enhanced by this understanding. So
right.
I do think it's possible.
It is sad though.
I think it's important to put the information out there for the people who want it. Cause I don't think it's right to teach someone for 70 years, wax the car. And when they're 70, they say, hey, is there anything more to this wax the car? Nope. Daniel-san, that's it. Wax the car. Mm-hmm. It's all literal.
Right. I mean, we have gotten so distracted and off message in mainstream culture. Maybe we're in need from another visitation from the culture seeders.
Well, I would say that the culture that happens to be very descended from the literalist perspective is the one that seems to be doing a lot of, you know, starting wars in different places.
A lot of harm.
Yeah. So I think there is actually a connection to the literal, like the literal interpretation enables, like gives intellectual cover for, oh yeah, well, we can seize this North America from the people who were here before because manifest destiny.
Yeah.
Right. And so you can get people who might otherwise actually have a conscience. It can provide intellectual cover for a whole lot of murder and other horrendous stuff. So I do think that it's important to touch on that question.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you separate man from the information and you say, look, I'm the liaison between you and God. I'm the guy who knows what God's thinking. Me and him have this buddy-buddy relationship and I'll tell you what's up. And then, you know, this head of the Vatican, this Pope, goes and sanctions all this murder, and you're kind of left like, huh, I guess. I mean, he says he's the authority. He knows God. I guess I can't say anything. But, man, we've been all over the map. I do love it. You are so dedicated and passionate, and you work really fucking hard, man, and I am in awe. I know you've got a couple different URLs out there and obviously several different books. Please fill the people in and give them a little more info on where they can follow up on your work and get a little more Matheson.
Thanks, Greg. Yeah, so appreciate those kind words. And I would say that I'm actually not trying to tell people what they mean. I've given some suggestions as to what I believe at this point in my life that they are saying. But what I'm trying to do is give people the tools where you can go interrogate the ancient wisdom for yourself and ask what it means and go. And actually, I think it tells you how to go to the spirit realm, you know, and ask those questions too. I think that's what it is about in a lot of ways. So as you mentioned, I have a long running blog. That's, if you just search for the word Matheson and stars, you'll find a whole host of links. So for a long time, the blog was kind of my website. And then not too long ago, I started a new website, a little more advanced looking and has more places you can go to the video section, go to the book section, and that's at starmythworld.com. That has some of those links to those resources that I talked about. If you scroll to the very bottom of any page, it'll have resources. It also has a link to the blog, and the blog, like I said, is searchable, so you can search for different topics, different stars, different myths. You can search for the Odyssey, whatever, and see what I've written about. And then the books section has some sample content from each of my books, including, I mentioned the Matheson Corollary. That was my first one. I was actually still taking the Bible literally when I wrote that one. So in between Matheson Corollary, there was this 3-year period where I went through this major spin cycle. And then The Undying Stars is when, that's the first book where I realized, you know, I'm publishing what I know about the celestial content of all the myths. So,
and not to cut you off, but do you have any bitterness from the years of deception that you were, you know, instituted into? Because I do.
Yeah, you know, so I try not to, Greg. I mean, I did give, you know, give money to to churches and to
what's the point of that?
Yeah, friends of mine who were, but you know what? I try not to. I was I actually believe I gained a lot of good things from those years. I think they gave me a lot of good insights. I do think that I had a lot of beliefs about politics and economics that are very different than what I have today, right? My view of the world. But if you don't, if you don't change, then you're always stuck in the same place. I would say the one thing that's kind of tricky is when you're raising your kids and telling them, because you believe it yourself and they're young and you're telling them this, and then you have to go to them and say, I don't believe that anymore. It's really, they're probably have been through the, it's a lot easier to, I think, deal with these major changes and go, oh, I have to throw out that hypothesis. Like I said, I think trying on different hypotheses is really important, and being able to change when you realize, hey, you know what, this evidence that's not fitting in forces me to reconsider this hypothesis. I think we have to be able to do that. I think it's a good lesson for kids too, but it's easier to do that when you're an adult than a child.
I know. And it's not really fair to put kids through that. I mean, obviously it started with me at a young age. I'm sure it started with you at a young age. And I mean, if we've recognized that there's deception and we've woken up from it, don't we sort of owe it to our friends and neighbors and loved ones to kind of shut that shit down?
Well, I do believe that, we should, like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, do what's right without attachment to the outcome. So I don't know what the outcome will be, but I think what we got to do is the task that we see in front of us. We got to try and figure out what's right to do in that situation and then do it. So I think that I could say, hey, I figured this out, but wouldn't it's been secret for so long. Maybe it should kind of stay a secret. I believe that what I'm doing is right to try and put out the information.
Of course.
I absolutely believe that's right. Now going around and trying to shut down, there's a lot of people who, there's all kinds of like traditional family traditions and things, rituals and stuff. I think it's when it becomes, I think there's a lot of good. I think these things contain truth. I think it's when it is being used to cover over, hey, I can take away your land. Hey, I can start this war with you. Hey, I can do all this kind of deception or racism or sexism or hold women down because Eve is the one who sinned, right? Well, no, she's a constellation and I can show you that. So I think we have to oppose racism, sexism, exploitation, oppression, and violence. I absolutely think that we got to do that. Now, going and blasting away somebody, walking up to somebody and saying, hey, that tradition that your grandfather taught you, it's all BS. I don't think that's actually the right answer. I think you could say, hey, I think that actually teaches something really beautiful that maybe you haven't heard. Would you like to know that? That's something different.
Mm-hmm.
So I do believe that we absolutely have to be adamant against violence, exploitation, and oppression wherever we see it. So, and people enabling it, yeah, I think it should be called out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was going to be kind of my next little question is, when does indoctrinating the developing minds of children in this false paradigm of religious authority become child abuse?
Oh, man. So, Greg, you ask really good, insightful, deep questions that, I think are actually right to ask. So what I think is there's a system called Montessori. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
But I've heard the term.
I'll just use it as a quick metaphor, and hopefully I'm not dragging on too long.
But no.
Montessori is a great way of teaching children. And what it does is it takes abstract concepts and it gives them physical form. There's actually a tool in Montessori. Children can play with this thing and construct it, put it together. It's called the binomial cube. And there's another one called the trinomial cube. And there's these bead chains that represent, the fives table or the tens table. They're learning, the seven times seven is 49. And look here, these beads, if you stack them up, they make a square, 49,
right.
Seven squared. You teach them the binomial cube, okay? They may be 3 years old when they're introduced to the binomial cube. Now, most of us encounter binomials like in high school algebra because it's this formula when you take A plus B times A plus B with parentheses, and then you get A squared plus AB plus BA, that's a binomial. Three-year-olds don't usually learn binomials, but they learn the binomial cube and they play with it. And then actually much earlier than high school, Montessori teaches a first grader, a second grader, a third grader, hey, you know that cube you've been playing with? Yeah, the binomial cube. Yeah, I know it. Well, you know what it is? It's a binomial. Well, what's a binomial? Let me show you. And then you show them and you say, see this little red cube in the binomial cube that you've been putting together? That's A cubed. And see this square part that has red just on one side in a square? That's A squared. And the kid goes, whoa! Now I understand a binomial, and now I know what the binomial cube's all about. It's like Danielson had to get first taught wax the car. And Mr. Miyagi didn't say, by the way, this will be how to stop Johnny's crazy roundhouse kick. He just waxed the car. But it would be a crime to leave him forever at the age of 70 and say, oh, you know what, binomials, you don't get to know those. See, I don't think it's wrong to teach the children David and Goliath. And then I do think it's wrong to never tell them, hey, now you're 13, age of manhood, or age of womanhood, whatever. Let me tell you what, David and Goliath, it's actually about this. Oh, wow. You mean that applies to me? Yep, it applies to you. It's not really about David and Goliath, because David's right here in the sky and Goliath's right there. Oh.
And that's exactly what the church hides, right? I mean, they never give you that later lesson, and they teach the literal myth. I mean, that's exactly what you're fighting against.
Well, they never gave it to me in the 20 years I was
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Right? It's a system of deception. They've perverted the myths. I mean, that's kind of what we've been talking about the whole time. But the thing is they still do it today. They're doing it on Sunday, probably just a few blocks away from your house, and the pattern repeats.
So I'm telling you, yeah. I think it's fine to teach it to children, but I think it has to be, you teach them the kung fu later on, and it has to be, hey, this kung fu is not for oppressing and hurting people or taking away their stuff. It's for protecting, you know, when that person who's weaker is getting oppressed by this bully, you may need to use it. And I think that all the spiritual components, you know, we started this whole thing off talking about spirit world. I think that whole spirit component is absolutely real, you know, that you talk about with Gordon White. You haven't had him on there for 6 episodes because it's not real. He's talking about real stuff, right?
Yeah, of course.
And actually in Solomon, there's a vision where Solomon is asked in a dream, what do you want, Solomon? I'll give you anything. And Solomon says, I want wisdom. And God says to him, because you didn't ask for riches and because you didn't ask for hurting your enemies, I'm really happy that you asked for wisdom. I'm going to give you a wise heart, and I'll give you also, you know, riches and good things too. But so we're not supposed to go to the spirit world to hurt our enemies or gain riches. That's not, you know, when Solomon makes his choice, God is happy that it's for wisdom and helping. And he actually says, I need wisdom to help the people. And then the next thing that happens is he helps these two women with the situation and the babies. That's the purpose of it. So, yeah, I absolutely believe that people who are using things for domination, it needs. But I do think there's probably also a lot of people who are teaching it who sincerely believe it is literal. I do think that.
Right. But Nazi soldiers, they thought they were doing the right thing by following their orders too.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm putting this out there publicly. Yeah, I absolutely agree. We need to stand against violence and that good people. Yeah. So that's absolutely right. Good people. I was in the army for a long time. I never thought anything that I was doing was wrong. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. Now I look at what's going on and I say, oh my goodness, can't anyone see what the heck is going on? It's not about what you think it's about. So
we live and learn.
Yeah, you gotta wake people up. So I do agree that there is that component. No, I think, Greg, your instincts are absolutely right. I mean, your heart is absolutely telling you the right thing. I do think we have to stop those things. And I think the right way is to actually wake people. Like what Martin Luther King did was to appeal to people's conscience and say, look, here's the way to stop it, is to show people, hey, you're not really for hitting people over the head with bats and axe handles, are you? I don't think you're really about that.
No.
See, he woke people up to that, as opposed to trying to say, well, I'm going to overthrow that with violence is not going to work.
Right. And you make a great point. I mean, that is what your work is doing. The noble goal of enlightening and waking people up. That's what you do. And you're dedicated to it. And it shows. I really appreciate it. I'm sure the people do as well. Thanks, man. I mean, always a pleasure. You are the man.
No, you the man.
We got to start wrapping it up somewhere. Might as well be here. Thanks for doing it again. Always a pleasure. Take care out there.
Thank you, Greg.
You got it, man. But that's not all, folks. After already being kind enough to spend an extra half hour with us on today's show, Dave hit me up and said, you know, I was thinking about some of those topics towards the end, Saturn and elitism in particular, and I kind of want to say a bit more on that for the people, if we could. And of course, I'm going to let a man make his point, so we hopped back on the line to record a little icing for this particular THC cake. So keep your lap bar securely fastened, because this ride ain't over just yet. So this will be a little addendum to that show, because we didn't fully wrap up the points about Saturn, and I guess the idea that Saturn, or the question of, is Saturn the god of this world? So I will turn the mic over to you, David. What do you think?
Great. Yeah, so very important question. Thanks for putting a little addendum on, because I do want to kind of clarify a little bit. So I mentioned elitism, and I really don't want anyone to come away with the impression that I'm trying to excuse the concept of elitism. And I mentioned that some people, in fact, Robert Taylor believes that the word elitism comes from the name for Saturn, Elus, E-L-U-S. He talks about this actually in Astronomico Theological Lectures. But I don't want anyone to think that I am pro-elitism. Actually, I think that is a total inversion of everything that I've been trying to talk about.
Right, right.
Yeah, you know, what I believe the ancient myths are actually saying, using the stars to explain, is that every single man and woman has an inner connection to the infinite, or to the divine, if you want to call it that. Like I mentioned that quotation from Plato right at the beginning of the conversation, that each man and woman is a combination of animal and God. There's a divine aspect, but we often forget that divine aspect, or we deny it in ourselves and in others. And what we're supposed to be trying to do is reintegrate with both parts, so that we're, you know, lifting up rather than beating down ourselves and others. So elitism actually turns that on its head by saying some people are better than others. You know, the elite,
right?
You know, elite soldiers are better than everybody else, or elite people can sacrifice the kind of the mobs and the masses to make a better world for themselves. That's the total inversion of the idea that every single man and woman and child that you ever meet has this inner divine spark or inner connection to the infinite, and is equally infinitely valuable. So that's the main thing I wanted to tie it into. So, and I'll throw it back to you to help me clarify it, but to tie it back in, what I was trying to explain is, I believe the whole Osiris myth, which is also related to the Saturn myth and the Kronos in ancient Greece, the Titan Kronos, or Kronos, who is the son, he's the premier Titan who takes charge to overthrow his father Uranus, or Uranus, the god of the sky, you know, the infinite heavens. Kronos famously overthrows his father. We can, you know, I don't want to go too long, but we could get into this. We could get into the story and show how it is related to Orion, the same constellation that Osiris is related to, and then that in Latin becomes the god Saturnus or Saturn. And actually, Robert Taylor alleges that the name Elus is the Phoenician name for the same god, Saturnus in Latin, Elus in Phoenician. So that's where this word elite, according to some people, and Robert Taylor actually cites a very early literalist Christian writer and a ferocious arguer for literalism against Gnosticism named Eusebius. An ancient writer named Eusebius is actually the source for Robert Taylor's assertion that Elus, E-L-U-S, is Saturnus, is Kronos, the same figures, where we get the word elite. So to round off my point, I believe that myth actually of Osiris being slain and banished to the underworld, all the myths actually are trying to elaborate on our human condition, that we are like a god, that's been banished to the underworld. We have this divine spark, but we've been encased in clay. Just like Osiris goes down under the underworld, our divine spark has been encased in clay inside our human body, which is, you know, made of water and earth or the lower elements. So it's actually a message that's supposed to uplift everybody or supposed to tell you who you really are. Hey, you have a divine spark. Don't forget that part of you. And everyone else you meet has a divine spark. Elevate that. Don't focus just on the clay. Focus on the divine spark and try and bless and elevate that spark. And then to take that and turn it into elitism, which says, oh, yes, we can do these horrible things because Saturn is the god of this world, would be a terrible inversion and, I believe, a mistake in, or a misinterpretation or an inversion of what the ancient wisdom in all these myths is trying to teach.
Fair enough. But, you know, we do see a lot of conspiracy researchers pointing out multiple Saturnian references in pop culture and in logos of companies. You know, a lot of these guys, they talk about that's what the elite are doing. They worship Saturn. They're trying to bring the archons from the Saturnian realm into our existence. And obviously, you can get into symbolism like the black cube, which is shown a lot of places, and the cap and gown from Graduation is apparently a Saturnian reference. So, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of Saturn stuff in our culture, and these researchers talk about it being because, you know, the elite secretly are worshiping this dark entity represented by the planet Saturn. I mean, is that what you think some of that stuff's about? Do you think they're misinterpreting the myths?
Yeah, so all those researchers that you're talking about are talking about real evidence. So the question is, you know, how do we fit this evidence? Actually, nothing that I said denies the possibility that there are people who believe themselves to be elite and are either literalizing these myths or they understand the Gnostic aspects, applications, what I call the kung fu kind of applications of these myths very well. And they've chosen to be like the Cobra Kai school, you know, in the Karate Kid, the Cobra Kai school, they know karate. They just happen to be using it to beat up on everybody and take Johnny out at that chain link fence and sucker punch him and then just wail away on him as much as they want. Once they've sucker punched him once, he can't stop any more kicks. So Johnny can just keep hitting him in the face.
Right.
So, you know, all those things that you mentioned, you know, they also point to the black robes in the court system.
Right.
So black is a Saturnian color in, I mean, there's layers and layers and layers of this knowledge. And there are people who are very knowledgeable about the astrological, you know, there's layers of astrological knowledge. If you set up the zodiac wheel, the sun is associated with a certain place on that astrological wheel, and then the moon is next to the sun, and then you go out from Mercury is on either side of that pair, and then Venus is on either side of Mercury, and you work your way out, and you get all the way down to Saturn will end up being exactly opposite the sun. So they are actually adversaries, astrologically speaking.
Right.
You know, adversary is actually a term that we have in court, right? Or there's devil's advocate. Well, adversary is the opposite. In the Bible, John the Baptist says he must rise or he must increase, I must decrease. This is, you know, this is celestial language.
Right.
When one constellation on one side of the of space, as we're facing space out into the night sky, when there's a constellation on that side is rising, the constellation on the other side of the, as we're turning, is going down. All these things are actually celestial imagery. So, but they're not just talking about, they're talking about the real spiritual plane. That's what I'm trying to say is all these myths are not just, and I'm putting little quotation marks with my fingers, not just about the things that are happening out in space, as majestic and magnificent as those celestial phenomena are, but they are actually a stand-in to help us to understand truths about an invisible realm that does have invisible powers in it that are spirits. You know, the Egyptians called them Neters or Neturu, the gods, these powers, these entities that a shaman will go consult with for good or for bad purposes, those are real phenomena. Those are real aspects of the dual spiritual material realm in which we inhabit. And the myths are trying to tell you about that. So to wrap up a very long answer to a very good question that you just asked, I don't know whether someone is A, misinterpreting it, or B, they understand it very well and they're tapping into the higher kung fu that the wax on, wax on, wax off represents. They know the karate, and perhaps some people who know karate are using it to be like the Cobra Kai school as opposed to being like the Mr. Miyagi school of protect Daniel-san and not go around beating people up.
Right. It's hard to really understand what's going on with the elite. I mean, you had written here that your position is that elitism is bullshit because each man and woman is equally connected to the infinite realm and contains the infinite or the divine realm within them. So elitism tries to turn that on its head, invert the myth, and say that, you know, basically it argues that some are better than others. I guess the question is, can the elite, with enough dedication, are they able to change the myth or change the impact of the myth? Basically, through this inversion, are they destroying the original meaning?
Wow. So this is why it's so great to have someone asking great questions, because it helps bring, you know, new thoughts out that, you know, those are, that's a fantastic question, Greg. I'll tell you this. I don't know, you know, I don't know all these answers. I am trying to explain the language to point people to the original ancient wisdom and say, hey, go consult the ancient wisdom. It teaches these wonderful truths. I think these are the truths that it's teaching. But once you know the language, you can go ask. But
fair.
So I'm not trying to also make a cop out. So now I'm going to answer your question. I'm saying I don't know the answer. No, don't. I'm not setting myself up as the guru or the interpreter of this information. I'm pointing people to the source of the wisdom itself. But I will say, I think it is possible to trick people or to try to deceive people into thinking that they are not worth anything.
Right.
That they are not powerful. Okay. And so elitism basically says, oh, look at the masses, right? Democracy, what a failure. Of course it's a failure because you have these unwashed rabble voting for president. I mean, look at what the rest of the world must be, you know, I'm trying not to bring politics into this, but the whole world must be looking at what's going on right now and saying, oh my goodness, you're right. A democracy is a horrendous failure. Look at these two main candidates that the American people are putting forth. And I would say, I hope that the rest of the world knows that probably 90% of the United States is horrified, or of the men and women that are watching this spectacle right here in this country where we're living are horrified and going, what on earth is going on? This does not represent me. I hope nobody else thinks this does.
Right.
But the point is, you know, it could be a gigantic spectacle to undermine the whole idea of that men and women can rule themselves without an elite. Okay. So I don't know if that's a good example to answer your question, but what I'm saying is I'm not sure if the ancient wisdom can be changed. I don't think so. I think this is universal truth about every single man and woman is infinitely valuable, and doing violence to them or doing violence to a child is infinitely wrong. There's nothing you can do to actually change that. That is totally wrong. But you can get people to think, oh yeah, I'm nothing. I'm just a private in the army, and this guy yelling at me is the right situation. This is the natural order of things. I should just open myself up to this abuse. I don't think someone should open themselves up to abuse, but you do get these kind of psychological Stockholm syndromes or codependence, you know, that's an actual fact of life where people do believe that they deserve to get abused. And that's wrong. That's wrong, but that's an inversion of the truth, or it's an inversion of the real situation. And everyone knows, you know, everybody wants to tell that person, hey, stop letting him treat you like that. Why are you doing this to yourself? And say, wake up. Don't do that. So it's a complex question you ask, but I think it's possible to trick or to impose a lie on everybody.
Right.
We know that's true. We know it's true to impose a lie on everybody, but I don't believe that it changes the truth.
Well, it could be as simple as, I mean, if Saturn really does represent power, or, you know, dark power in some type of way, I mean, it could just be as simple as through esoteric workings, through magical ritual, they are communicating with this entity or a pantheon of archontic entities that reside in the Saturn area. And they could just be paying tribute to them in exchange for a little extra oomph when it comes to their power and control. It's no surprise that the actual references we see come from some of the biggest companies, the most powerful players on the world stage. I'm sure it's not a coincidence. I mean, maybe they're doing it out of superstition, but maybe that's how they're actually getting a little bit of their power or retaining their power.
No, and that, like, you know, I use the Kung Fu example. Kung Fu really works, and it can be used to actually harm people or any martial art, right? Ones that really work can be used for protecting others or hurting others. And so if tapping into, and which I believe is true, tapping into the invisible realm really works, which it does, then it can be used just like bad, you know, the Cobra Kai karate school.
Right.
And it's also numbers and symbolism of the number 72 and the number 108. These are numbers that have to do with precession, and the actual Orion myth, the Osiris myth, as I was kind of explaining a little bit, this is the, you know, I was opening up this door, but I didn't fully elaborate on it. So I felt like I wanted to make sure I didn't open up, and it is a huge can of worms. I can't completely close it, but I didn't want to feel like I opened up a can of worms and just left it wide open with worms going everywhere. Osiris is held under the earth and killed by Set, his brother Set. That is a processional myth, and it can be shown to be a processional myth. Hamlet's Mill talks about it, a book called Death of Gods in Ancient Egypt by Jane B. Sellers has some very good explanation of it. I talk about it in volume one of Star Myths of the World. Set is the brother that kills Osiris. This is just like in Lion King, where Scar kills Mustafa, and then the son, which is Simba in The Lion King, the son has to deal with this. Okay, the father and the son in the Egyptian myth is Horus, is the son of Osiris that has to battle with Set. And in the Hamlet, the reason Hamlet's Mill is called Hamlet's Mill is if you read Shakespeare's Hamlet, the exact same thing happens. The king, old Hamlet, has been killed by his brother Claudius, and then young Hamlet has to deal with the situation, just like Scar killed Mustafa in Lion King. So that's why Hamlet's Mill is called that. There was a Germanic myth about a character named Amleithus. And if you read Hamlet's Mill, it's basically explaining this Saturnian story around the world with all these different figures, Jamshid in ancient Persia and Exiata, which may be the source of the Yima Exiata, might be the source of the word Saturn or the god Saturn. So what I'm trying to say is they do use these Saturnian symbols, or we do see these Saturnian symbols popping up. Like, oh, this couple was married for 72 hours and then got a divorce. Huh. I wonder if that's a coincidence. 72. Osiris was slain by Set and his 72 buddies. You know, why does 72 keep popping up everywhere? Why does 108? And I believe those numbers actually have to do with, you know, the myth that tells us that we are all divine on the inside, but we're down here in this underworld and we have to reconnect with our higher self, all these positive things. I don't think those numbers are negative, just like the King Arthur myth. Is King Arthur a negative figure? Are we afraid of King Arthur? King Arthur is the same pattern. The Saturn figure is banished into the underworld and has to sleep in this cave of Ogygia under the waves, the magical cave under the ocean. King Arthur is charmed underneath the lake by the Lady of the Lake, and he's sleeping down there somewhere. And someday he'll come back. He's the ruler of this lost golden age, and someday he'll come back. All these myths are actually trying to tell us about the invisible world, about our connection to the infinite, King Arthur is not a, he's a benevolent figure that ruled over a golden age that's now lost. Mm-hmm. So is Saturn. So is Osiris. I think it's being inverted. And so using a bunch of King Arthur symbolism shouldn't in and of itself be negative. But I do believe there are people inverting these myths. So I do believe that is going on.
Yeah, it's undeniable. It's definitely happening. I could bring up.
That's what I wanted to clarify. Now, you know, that's the main thing I wanted to clarify.
Sure,
I believe this inversion is going on, but I do believe it's an inversion, and it does need hurting little children should be stopped.
Well,
and,
yeah.
And organizations that do that must be stopped from doing that, right? Or broken up. You know, you don't allow that to keep going on. So,
right.
And you don't say, oh, well, Saturn devoured his children, so. This is a pattern that he's the god of this world, so we can do it with impunity. No, you can't. And so it's universal law that's baked into the world, or God's law, or the divine law. It's actually an inversion of what I believe. But like I said, inverted or literalistic interpretations can be used to give false cover or false justification. Oh, we're allowed to go take these people's land away from them because of this literalistic interpretation. That's an inversion,
right?
So that's what I wanted to say.
For sure, man. Cool. Well,
I don't want to make it a 3-hour show, but
no,
I wanted to get that out.
It's almost gonna be there anyway, which is totally fine. I mean, it's not the end of the world. I mean, that's the joy of having full control over my own airwaves, is it can really be however long it needs to be. It's just you start asking people for more than 2 hours and they generally kind of recoil.
Well, no, thank you, man. I came back to you, you know, so the listeners know, and said, hey, I felt like we kind of opened up this big door and I don't feel like I explained what I was trying to say.
For sure.
So hopefully that explains it a little more. It's a huge, deep topic that
it is.
But this stuff touches on everything is truly the case here.
I mean, you've covered it in multiple 500-page books and you're still not done. So it is a deep rabbit hole for sure. Is there anything else you wanted to add just to put a fine point on the larger scope of our conversation before we really call it in?
No, I think this is, you know, I really want to say thank you. It is necessary to, you know, conversations is how we, you know, we should be getting together with our friends and talking things over, because like when more people get together, it's like some third knowledge that wasn't there before comes out. It's like, well, that wasn't just for me and it wasn't just from you. It's this third additional knowledge that rises up out of the cauldron when we're all stirring it. But
amen.
The closing idea that I believe is the important message is don't get caught up in the labeling of the external. Oh, that person is a, you know, they're trying to divide us up by race, because it's very easy to do that.
Right.
You just, it's so easy to incite that. Oh, those people are coming over here to Europe and raping our daughters. Okay, well, great. I hate them now. That it is absolutely very easy to divide people by the externals. And the ancient wisdom is actually telling us, hey, the external part isn't what matters. You know, it's not the part that matters in you. You know, it's the inner, this inner connection that's the part that really matters. Someone might say, well, my tradition is this set of myths and your tradition is that. Well, I'm saying if you go back far enough, they're obviously all from the same place.
Right.
So we're all part of the same tradition. You can show that with these constellations. So don't focus on the external. Don't let them divide us up. And, you know, even when you're driving down the street and someone cuts you off, remember that's a
divine spark right there.
That's an infinite person in there. You know, give them the same kind of, you know, you've done the same, you've been taken over by your emotions probably plenty of times. I know I have. So
right.
That's what we got to try and focus on, because they will try and divide us along those external lines. They absolutely are doing that.
Wise words. And I agree with what you say about conversation. One of the most common emails I get is people saying, man, I just love this show because there is nobody I can talk to about these ideas in my regular life. I can't talk to family. They wouldn't get it. Can't talk to friends. Can't bring it up to coworkers. God, no. So I understand that a lot of people are out there wanting to scratch that itch, and it's difficult. So they kind of listen as a third party in the little smoke circle here, And they're just kind of a, you know, a silent person on the line, but people appreciate it. I appreciate you coming back and adding that, this little bonus to the end of it. And with that, man, take care of yourself. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Hey, likewise. I wish you a million more excellent shows and sacred plants.
All right, people. This one is not a drill. It's the real thing. Another THC episode comes to a close. A part of me did want to break down more individual myths with David, but I think you really need the visual context that he gives in the books to really see the point he's making when it comes to interpreting some of the symbols. But I appreciate his work. He is quite a beast with books this huge. And I know David is a Plus member too, so please leave some comments or questions for him and hopefully he'll jump in. That seems to be the most active place for feedback these days anyway. We were also talking again today in email because I had some thoughts about some of those nefarious passages like the ones in Leviticus. If a man commits adultery with another man's wife, with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress are to be put to death. Or if a man has sexual relations with a man as one does with a woman, both of them have done what is detestable. They are to be put to death. Their blood will be on their own heads. And then there's that big paragraph about the logistics of buying slaves in Genesis. Now these are the rules that you shall set before them. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free, for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with and all, and he shall be his slave forever. And those things don't sound good. So I asked David, what's up with this stuff? These passages pretty clearly don't have anything to do with star myths. And he said, you just got to parse out the stories from the Bible and connect them to the other stories. Of course, there's a lot of other stuff jammed in that book too that isn't really relevant. And I get that. Clearly, we know entire books were left out of the official canon of the Bible. So I will give him that. Totally fair points. But I am glad we came back to talk about Saturn more. Did you see the headline going around the last few days that Saturn is changing colors and nobody knows why? What's up with that, people? But there we have it, an extended show to close out the month of October. Of course, there is another hour there for the Plus people, but even the free show, I think, here is close to 2 hours. If you're not a member of the Higher Side Chats Plus yet, just go over to thehighersidechats.com, scroll down to the bottom, sign up for the free week trial, and you can hear everything I've ever done in the next 7 days. On the house, if you really want to do that to me. But I hope everyone's enjoying the good time we call Halloween, and I'll be back before you know it. Your move, conspirators of the cancerous context of the ancient, fragmented, universal system of knowledge, your fucking move.
Lucid dreams are so vivid, cause you go to bed at 7, and your brain comes alive, cause you hate your 9-to-5. You wake up with a dread, and make sure your cats are fed. Did your brain talk to a ghost, who moved your coffee and your toast, as you listen to the Higher Side Chats? You get to your desk, and your boss says it's a mess, and your soul slowly grows to a place where nothing grows. When you think he's not around, you insert a SETI sound. The OM says turn it down, and you say it's just the Higher Side Chats. Oh, do you think you'd be invited to Bohemia Grove, to a Bilderberg Club? Oh, do you think you'd be invited by a Rothschild to a party on a submarine? Diving down to the center of the earth, to the Marianas Trench, your teeth begin to clench from the sulfurous stench. The mask you're given doesn't fit, cause you're not one of them. Starting today, you'll make plans to get away. There's no one to hold you down, and the what-ifs start to drown. Then you wake to the glare of a cold fluorescent stare, and the light winks at you, cause its life is almost through, but it's holding on to quit time just like you. It's time for the Higher Side Chats.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehighersidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the five shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provide it all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site if you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices. I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon, but I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehighersidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehighersidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle, sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the five shows the previous month, and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?